making lunch for us in his apartment. I broached the subject by saying I wanted to live in Seoul. Why? He turned the gas up and was jiggling the pan, stirring chopped celery with a bamboo spatula. He was pulling a face. Korean Chinese suffer from low status in South Korea, he said over the hiss. You know that.
I know.
One of my reasons, though I'd hoped I wouldn't have to spell it out, was so that we could marry. I watched him add squid and mushrooms and salt and pepper. You have a good life here, better than you'd have in Seoul. You're Chinese. This is your country. This was not encouraging. A dash of sake and soy sauce, and lunch was ready. It was delicious, but I ate in silence. Is this what's got into you lately? He was speaking with a mouthful of steaming food. His reasoning was that I'd be half foreign in South Korea because I was Korean Chinese. I tell you, people there don't make it easy for ethnic Koreans from elsewhere. They treat Korean Americans as foreigners and look down their noses at the Chinese. I have a particular reason. What's that? I took a deep breath. I'm not Chinese. What do you mean? He was lifting his bowl to scoop more food into his mouth. I'm not a Chinese citizen. My ID is a fake. I'm not even Korean Chinese. He put his bowl down.
I don't follow.
I'm North Korean. He stared at me for a long moment as if I'd made a sick joke.
What?
I'm from North Korea. That's why I want to go. I was born and brought up in Haesan, in Yangang province, North Korea. I can't return home, so I want to go to the other part of Korea. He dropped his chopsticks on the table and slumped back in his chair. After a pause I thought would never end, he said,
I never expected this. I've heard you 100 times on the phone with your family. They're in Shenyang.
No, they're in Haesan, on the North Korean border with China. He gave a huff of incredulity.
How could you keep this from me for 2 years?
His mouth was taut with hurt.
How could you lie to my face all that time?
He was far more upset at my deceiving him than at learning that I came from the enemy country. Please try to understand, I said, keeping my voice level. When I was in Shenyang, I had a serious problem and was almost sent back to North Korea because I had told people the truth about myself. I came to Shanghai because no one here knew me. Only one North Korean friend here knows the truth. Now you do. That makes 2 people. Again, he was silent for a long time, looking at me, seeing me anew. The winter sun slanted into the room, casting his face in sharp relief, and I thought I'd never seen him so beautiful. Gradually the hurt went out of his eyes and was replaced by curiosity. I told him the story of how I crossed the frozen Yalu River and of my life in China. At the end of it, he reached over and took my hands. Then he surprised me by laughing, a relaxed, gentle, would-you-believe-it kind of laugh.
In that case, you should definitely go to South Korea. Let's spend New Year here, then go.
I think I loved him more at that moment than I ever did before or after. I booked the ticket for January 2008. My mother remained totally opposed, but relented when she understood there was no changing my mind. Kim was too important in my life now, but I still hadn't plucked up the courage to tell her about him. She still hoped I would one day return to Haesan. At this time, I entered my details into a defector site called People Search to see if I could find anyone from Haesan. I put in the name of my last school and year of graduation and left my email address. Within a day, I had received a message from someone who said she was from Haesan, though not from the same school. We talked by chat, When she said she was in Harbin, I mentioned that I was in Shanghai. I was reluctant to veil more. I didn't say it, but I half expected her to be a man, and probably a Puibu agent operating in China.
"Do you have a webcam?" she said.
She must have sensed my suspicion.
"I'll turn on my video chat so you can decide if I'm a woman and not a spy, okay?"
The picture came on. In the grey-pink half-light was a smiling woman of about my age, but to my surprise, her shoulders and chest were bare. Kim was sitting next to me and peered closer.
"Are you naked?"
I said.
"Yeah, sorry, I'm at work."
Kim and I looked at each other.
"If a customer calls, I'll need to switch the chat, so I don't have time to put clothes on."
What kind of job is that?"
"Video chatting," she said brightly.
She said her name was Shinsa. She'd been trying to get to South Korea, but had been caught in Kunming and deported back to North Korea. Kunming is the southwestern city that North Koreans head for en route to Southeast Asian countries that accept their asylum requests. A year later, she had escaped again and was doing this job to make money to pay a broker to get to South Korea.
"You chose that job?"
"No, of course not." She gave a sad laugh. "Most of the brokers who help defectors are human traffickers. They help women escape, not men. They're paid to bring us to China either as brides or prostitutes. What I'm doing is a kind of prostitution, I guess, but it's very new. I'd rather do this than be a real prostitute."
By this time, all my suspicions had vanished. "I'm going to Seoul soon. If I succeed, I'll help you get there," I told her.
I was determined to help this girl. As the date of my flight approached, I got more and more nervous about the check-in procedure at Shanghai Pudong International Airport. I was booked on a flight for Seoul with only a visa for Thailand. Kim said, "If you're worried, call the airport and ask." The official I spoke to at immigration was dubious. "It would not be impossible for me to pass through," he said, "but it would be difficult."
"First, look at the map. It's hard for anyone to figure why you would want to fly up to South Korea when you were going south to Thailand. Second, a lot of Korean Chinese go to Seoul and don't come back. That's a problem for both countries. You will need to persuade us why you want to do it this way. If you succeed, we will stamp your passport and you can pass."
I visualized the inspection process at the airport, trying to anticipate what might happen and rehearse my answers. They might ask me anything, so I thought I should take all my documentation along with my passport, my driver's license, my ID, all the detritus of a prosperous, settled life in Shanghai. I was ready. Kim came to the airport and said goodbye. We had decided that traveling together risked complicating matters. "I'll call you from Seoul," I said. I didn't mention the alternative, not wanting to tempt ill fortune. In a few minutes, I was at the immigration counter.
"You're traveling to Thailand?" the man said, pursing his lips.
"Yes."
"That's a weird way to go."
"Excuse me?"
"Why are you traveling via South Korea? Your ticket is for Thailand, and you're transiting at Incheon. It's a roundabout way to go."
"My boyfriend is in Seoul. He's booked on the same flight as me from Incheon to Bangkok," I said. "We're doing the same on the way back." He held out his hand.
"Let me see your ID.
Now he's suspicious. Perhaps he thinks the passport is a fake. I put all my documents on the counter. That seemed to help. By now, I'd been there for 10 minutes as he examined each, and I was holding up the line. I was afraid but stuck. After what seemed like an age, he stamped my passport, looked up at me, and stamped it again. I took my documents and walked towards the gate. I had a 1-hour wait before boarding. Although it was mild in Shanghai, I was wearing a padded coat in readiness for sub-zero Korea. I was sweating with apprehension. Any moment now, I thought, that officer at the desk would realize this was a ruse.
Police would appear to seize me and take me away. I kept glancing around nervously. As soon as boarding started, I rushed to the front. I took my seat on the plane and kept an eye on the door for the police. Finally, it was closed, and the airplane taxied for takeoff. The stress flowed out of me like air from a tire. My head sank back against the seat. But within minutes, I had started worrying about what would happen at Incheon. I did not have the documents to pass. For years, I had been a fugitive in hiding. This would be the moment when I gave myself up. I felt a wave of terror. After just an hour, the pilot announced the beginning of the descent. Minutes later, we were flying over Seoul and Incheon. My heart was racing. I was excited and very frightened. Suddenly, the clouds parted and I had a steep angle view of a city that stretched to the horizon in every direction I could see. It looked like some endless geological formation, vast colonies of sand-coloured stalagmites with tiny cars moving between them. The border between North and South Korea is narrow, and the distance from Pyongyang to Seoul is barely 120 miles. Yet the two countries are as far away from each other as any in the world. I thought of my mother and Mino. I had called them on New Year's Day. Mino gave me the upsetting news that our mother was in the hospital. She had severely scalded herself at home. This added to the confusion of guilt and loss I was feeling. A hydraulic whine, and the wheels were being lowered for landing. Would I ever see her again? Part 3. Journey into Darkness. Chapter 37. Welcome to Korea. I joined the crowd of disembarking passengers, not knowing where to go or what to do. It felt like a race. People wheeling carry-on luggage scurried away as fast as they could. A few peeled off into the restrooms, and I wondered if they, like me, were buying time before some encounter with destiny at the immigration barrier. For so long, I thought of my arrival in Seoul as the end of a long personal journey. I had not given much thought to what would happen once I got there. I found myself dashing along with everyone else, in small, nervous steps. A sign coming up ahead directed any transit passengers away from immigration. My ticket would take me to Bangkok, if I wanted a way out. My stomach was filling with butterflies. I breathed in, slowed my pace a little, and committed myself to the confrontation ahead. The crowd fanned out into lines behind the immigration counters. I joined one for foreigners. We moved steadily forward, one person every minute or so, until there were five people standing in line between me and the immigration officer. My mouth was dry, but my palms were sweating. I had no idea what I would say to him. With a mounting anxiety, I watched him look carefully at each person, scan their passport, check a screen. 4 minutes, and it would be my turn. I heard the commotion behind me and saw the line lengthening as passengers arrived from another flight. When I turned back, the line had moved forward again. Only three people in front of me. I was starting to feel stage fright and embarrassment. Two people in front of me. There was no way of avoiding a public spectacle when I stepped across the yellow line and declared myself an asylum seeker. One person in front of me. My courage failed. I left the line and went right to the back. As I stood there, I noticed a room over to the right. Through an open door, I could see officers in navy uniforms working at computers and three people sitting in front of them. Two women who looked Southeast Asian and a man who looked Chinese. I guessed there was something wrong with their documents. This would be less embarrassing than the immigration counter. I walked into the office. No one looked at me. My heart began beating so fast it made my voice sound strange, like a tape recording. "I'm from North Korea," I said. "I would like asylum." The officers all looked up. Then their eyes drifted back to their screens. The man who had looked up first gave me a tired smile.
"Welcome to Korea,"
he said, and took a sip from a plastic coffee cup. I felt deflated. I had thought my arrival would create a drama, but at the same time something primal in me reacted. He had just used the word Hangu. North and South Korea refer to themselves by different names in Korean. The South's name, Hangu, means country of the Han, a reference to the Koreans' ancient ethnicity. Its official name, in English, is Republic of Korea. The North calls itself Joseon, a name that derives from the time of Korea's Joseon Kingdom. Its official name is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Such is the hatred and ignorance created by a bloody history and by propaganda that we in the North grew up associating Hangu with enemy and all things bad.
Well done for getting here, he said. Please wait a minute.
He returned with two men in the same navy uniform and a woman in a dark skirt suit. One of the men carried a small scanning device. They asked for my passport and scanned it. They shook their heads and tried again. Something wasn't right.
Are you really North Korean? The woman said.
When she'd addressed her male colleagues, she had not used honorific forms of address. This convinced me that she was the senior one, the intelligence agent.
I am. Your passport and visa are genuine, she said. North Koreans don't come here with real passports. They have fakes.
It is a real passport, but that is not my real identity. I'm from North Korea.
I realized with alarm that she thought I was a Korean Chinese pretending to be North Korean so that I could get citizenship in the South.
Then my hand luggage caught her eye.
This Samsonite is real too, she said curtly. It's not a fake.
I hadn't noticed the Western trademark, so I didn't understand why she called my case Samsonite.
I had bought it because it looked sturdy. Later, I learned that South Koreans are very brand conscious. Only foreigners and defectors carry fakes.
She looked me in the eye, as if she caught me in a lie.
Tell the truth now, one of the officers said. It's not too late.
His tone was half threatening, half friendly.
I am telling the truth. Once you submit to an investigation by the NIS, there's no turning back. If you're Chinese, you'll be jailed, then deported to China, he said.
The National Intelligence Service was the agency that processed North Korean arrivals. I had heard that if they deported me, there would be a huge fine to pay in China. There was also a risk that the Chinese authorities would discover my deception and return me to North Korea. I had made it to South Korea, and now I was not being believed. I've made a terrible mistake.
The man continued. Tell us the truth, right now. You won't get into trouble. We'll let you go back to Shanghai.
He paused to let this option sink in.
I am telling the truth. My name's Pa Min Young. I'm willing to be investigated.
Even the truth sounded strange and dubious to me. I had not used that name in more than a decade.
All right. The woman shook her head. It's your decision.
I spent 2 hours being questioned alone by her in a windowless room and watching her taking notes. When I thought we'd finished, two other men in suits and open-neck shirts arrived. They were older, one in his 40s, the other with steel-grey hair in his 50s. From the way she greeted them, I understood that they were her superiors. Then she left. The men started questioning me all over again, from the beginning. They also didn't believe I was North Korean. The older man had an aggressive edge to his voice. By this time I was tiring and getting hungry and starting to lose the thread of the questions. The irony. In Shenyang, I'd had to convince suspicious police that I was Chinese, not North Korean. Here, I was trying to do the opposite. After 2 more hours, they told me we were going to the NIS processing center in Seoul. They led me through a side exit to a waiting car and driver. By now, it was early evening and dark. I had been at the airport for 5 hours. The vehicle was a gleaming civilian car that smelled new. I sat in the back with the younger man.
We drove past the terminal building and looped around on a 6-lane highway, lit sodium amber by the street lamps.
"This is the way to Seoul," the younger man said.
He was the nicer of the officers who had questioned me. His steel-haired colleague in the front said nothing. I tried to assess my situation. I'm not in jail. They haven't put me back on the plane. That counted as progress. This thought was quickly superseded by a less comforting one. What would my friends back home think if they knew who I was with right now? To North Koreans, the Angibu, as they call the NIS, was the sinister agency behind all road and rail disasters, building collapses, faulty products, supply failures and unexplained fires. Many people executed in North Korea, especially high-ranking cadres, are accused of having aided the Angibu.
"We've been busy," the man said. "This is our second trip to the airport today. Just before you landed, 150 North Koreans arrived and are now being processed."
"How many?"
150. Each week we're getting about 70 from Thailand and about the same number from Mongolia and Cambodia.
They were experiencing the biggest ever surge of defectors, he said, caused by a huge crackdown on illegals in China, part of a social clean-up before the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing. He asked me what I felt about the country I was now in, and started giving me basic facts about life expectancy, healthcare, average income. It sounded like a spiel he'd given many times. His aim was to puncture the false beliefs learned from propaganda. That people here are impoverished and persecuted. That the American soldiers stationed in Seoul gleefully kick children and the handicapped. North Korean propaganda is so grotesquely over the top that in debunking it, the South Koreans have no need to exaggerate. As long ago as the 1970s, when South Korea began rising towards the major league of world economies, all it took for North Korean defectors to unlearn decades of propaganda was a tour around a Hyundai automobile production line or the Lotte department store in Seoul. This even worked with highly indoctrinated commandos captured after failed secret missions to the south. We were driving in fast rush hour traffic along the Han River near Yeouido, a high-rise business district, great work highs coruscated with light. I looked up and saw a vision of plated gold glass, which I recognized from TV dramas.
"The 63 building," the agent said. "A landmark. 63 floors. We don't build them too high or there'd be targets for a North Korean attack."
So much light. So much wealth. All this had been going on while I was growing up, less than 300 miles away to the north. I shook my head as the full realization of where I was struck me. For a moment, I felt so excited I could hardly breathe. I was on the other side of my divided country. I was in the parallel Korea. It was vital and real. Compared with the sloth and gloom of the north, the energy and light everywhere was astounding me. We arrived at the monolithic processing center of the NIS. Armed sentries stood guard outside. The huge gate opened automatically without a sound, and I felt my excitement wane. My real investigation, as the agents put it, would soon begin. Chapter 38. The Women. I spent my first night in Seoul in a general detention room shared with about 30 North Korean women. The moment I entered, faces turned towards me, and I knew I would have trouble. Most of the women were older than me. Their eyes took in my fashionable Shanghai clothes, and I saw resentment. I had come straight from the airport. They looked as if they had spent years behind bars. Straight away, one of them demanded that I give her my clothes. About 20 of them, I learned, had indeed just come from prison. They had escaped on an epic journey across China to Thailand, where they had been jailed by Thai police before being released to the South Korean embassy. The experience had brutalized them. They lost no time in making sure I learned every detail.
Some 300 women had been packed into a space built to hold 100. Often, there wasn't even room to sit. If they didn't have cash to pay for a good spot, newcomers had to sleep next to a stinking latrine. In these conditions, tempers were continually at boiling point, and fights broke out. The Thai authorities released only a few detainees each week, so the wait lasted months. Since pregnant girls were given priority, some of the nastier women accused them of being queue-jumping sluts who deliberately conceived en route to Thailand. These accounts shocked me. I had thought that once defectors had made it out of China to another country, they could safely claim asylum. But in many of the women's stories, the real nightmare had begun only once they'd left China. The exceptions were the few women who had escaped via Mongolia, where the authorities had treated them well, housing them in decent facilities with their own kitchens. Violence was so casual among the women that the NIS guards had warned them. Physical fighting was a criminal offence and would hinder their progress towards South Korean citizenship. Despite this, heated rows erupted almost every day in our room. Almost all of them considered me soft and a fraud.
"You would never have survived Thailand," was a common snipe.
"You're not North Korean, are you?" was another.
"You look and sound Chinese."
I let them believe whatever they wanted. I owed them no explanation. But their attitude saddened me deeply. They were on the cusp of freedom, yet their negativity was so caustic, it could have dissolved the bars on the window. North Koreans have a gift for negativity toward others, the effect of a lifetime of compulsory criticism sessions. Lesbians were a frequent topic of conversation. In the humid crush of bodies in the Thai women's prison, I learned, everything took place in public, including sex. The dominant woman in our room was a large, imposing figure, with hair cropped like a soldier's. The others referred to her as the bully. She'd established her primacy in the Thai prison by physically assaulting any challengers. I was told she was a lesbian and that her girlfriend was in a separate room. The woman herself was candid about it and made her attraction to me plain. This was the first time I'd ever known that North Korea has gay people. I'm embarrassed to admit that I had thought of homosexuality purely as a foreign phenomenon or a plotline in TV dramas. One woman in the room told me that homosexuals in North Korea are sent to labor camps, that they suffer alone and cannot even confide in their families. I had not known this either. In fact, this was the first of many things I was to learn about my country. My political awakening was only just beginning. To avoid being bothered, I'd adopted a brusque manner and said little. Unfortunately, this afforded me no protection from the bully. I can only imagine how difficult her life had been in North Korea, and what she must have suffered there. Even so, she made my time in this room pure hell. I am 5'2" tall, and weigh just 100 pounds. She was so much larger than me, she could have flattened me with one blow. Initially, I tried to befriend her, for my own safety. But as the days passed, teasing turned to taunting, with an increasingly aggressive, sexual edge.
"I won't do anything bad to you until you're asleep."
Twice the guard came in and told her to cool it. She terrified me, but I knew the one thing I should not do was show fear. Soon she was singling me out almost hourly. She couldn't leave me alone. I realized I was going to have to talk back to her, even though she was older than me, and according to Korean culture, should be respected. Each day her taunts made me more tense and nervous, but I kept it hidden behind a mask of indifference. No one stood up to her, not even the older women. One of the younger of us was a subdued girl called Sunmi. We struck up a friendship of sorts. She had been caught 3 times in China, she told me, and each time she was sent back to North Korea, where the Puibu kicked her and beat her with batons. They asked over and over if she had met any South Koreans or Christians in China.
"What are Christians?"
she said.
I didn't know, so they kept hitting me.
The slightest noise, I noticed, of a door closing or of a chair scraping, sent Sunmi into a bunker in her mind. On an afternoon toward the end of my first week in the women's room, Sunmi was watching a television show I knew she'd been looking forward to. I was reading a book. The bully entered, sat directly in front of Sunmi so that she blocked her view of the screen, picked up the remote, and changed channel. It's funny how the final straw is invariably a trivial incident. I heard a voice yelling. It was mine. I was using foul language, which I had never used before in my life, and it was speaking disrespectfully to an older person. Also a first. In a scene that still seems unreal, I was directing a torrent of invective at this woman, the worst I could think of, finding within myself a rage I never knew I possessed. The others gaped, open-mouthed. The bully looked diminished suddenly. I didn't stop until I was out of breath. In the silence that followed, there was just the sound of my panting. One of the oldest women there turned to her.
This is what your behaviour's earned you. The disrespect of a young person. You've been humiliated.
After 2 weeks in the women's room, a guard came for me. It was time for my face-to-face interrogation with a special investigator. I was taken to a windowless cell and kept in solitary. It was grim, but I was relieved to be by myself. The cell had a wooden desk, two chairs, and a metal frame bed, with a blue woolen blanket and a small white pillow. It was 5 steps long and 4 steps wide. A bare bulb cast an anemic glow. A tiny surveillance camera watched me from one corner. The door was kept locked. Beside it was a telephone that connected me to a young guard who would unlock the door when I needed the bathroom. On the second morning, a middle-aged man in a suit entered, looked at me, glanced at his file, and left. A minute later, he returned.
You're 28.
Yes.
Your name's Pa Min Young?
Yes.
And your present age is 28.
Yes, that's correct. This man was my interrogator. I wondered why he double-checked and looked confused. The information must have been there in his hand. He asked me to write out my life story in as much detail as I could. Some people submit a thick wad of paper, like an autobiography, he said. This document would form the basis for his questions. He also asked me to draw a map of the part of Haesan where I lived. I spent a long time doing this and put in as much detail as I could remember. Often during the questioning, he went silent and stared deep into my eyes, tilting his head slightly as if searching for something. It was unnerving. It crossed my mind that this was some bizarre form of flirting. After what the women had told me about the Thai prison, nothing would have surprised me. I tried to keep a blank face. I didn't want to give him any ideas. I remained in solitary for a week. At first, I'd felt intimidated by my interrogator, but after a few days I looked forward to seeing him every morning at 9. He was my only human company. During one of my long afternoons alone, for something to do I practiced my Chinese calligraphy, writing down my thoughts and feelings on a couple of pages. I described the oppressive bleakness of the cell walls and stated my conviction that a room was incomplete without a window. Then I screwed the paper up and threw it in the trash can. The next morning, the young guard came into my cell. "Did you write this?" he asked. He was holding my crumpled sheet of paper. "So they're checking my trash." "What does it say?" "Just my thoughts and feelings," I said. "Is that allowed?" "Yes," he said, surprised. "I studied Chinese at university, that's all, so I tried to read it. I just wondered why you wrote it." "There's nothing to do." Early the next morning, he opened the door and put his head in. "It's snowing. Would you like to see?" He led me to the bathroom, opened the window, and left me there. It was just before dawn. A bar of gold along the horizon illuminated the underside of the clouds. Snowflakes were floating like goose down, such as I hadn't seen since I was a young girl. It was far below freezing. Lights burned in every building I could see, and dotted all across the city were glowing red crosses. There are so many hospitals, I thought. Later I learned that crosses marked churches, not hospitals. I'd never seen such signs in North Korea or China. It was magical. I thought of that far-off thundery day in Anju when I'd waited for the lady in black to come down with the rain.
If you grab her skirt, she'll take you back up there with her, Uncle Opium had said.
I'd been scared stiff she'd carry me away into another realm. In a way, she had, and I was looking at it. The next day, the interrogator smiled for the first time. The questioning was over, he said.
I believe you're North Korean.
How did you know? An enormous grin spread across my face. By now, I felt as if I'd known him for months.
The women think I'm Chinese.
He made a modest gesture with his palms.
I've been vetting people for 14 years, he said. After a while, you get a feel for the psychology. I can usually tell when people are lying.
How?
From their eyes.
I felt my face redden. That explained the lingering eye contact. He hadn't been flirting at all.
Still, you were a curious case, he said. You're in the 1% that I've seen in 14 years.
1%?
First, you're the only person I've met who arrived here easily, by direct flight from where you were living. Second, it took you no time to get here, just a 2-hour journey. And third, you didn't have to pay any brokers. That's what I mean. You just jumped on a plane. Was it your idea?
Yes.
Then you're a genius.
He was quite different now, talkative and friendly.
I knew things would go smoothly with you, because you didn't lie about your age. Most North Koreans do. The old ones claim to be older than they are in order to claim benefits. Young people make themselves younger so that they're eligible to study for free. But you said you were in your late 20s. When I came to question you, I expected to meet someone in her mid-30s, but you looked about 21. I thought I'd come to the wrong cell, so I went back to check. Why would a North Korean who looks 21 admit she's in her late 20s?
Because she's honest, I thought. I smiled, but a part of me thought I'd missed a trick here. The next morning I awoke refreshed. It was the first sleep I'd had without nightmares since I'd arrived at my uncle and aunt's in Shenyang more than 11 years before. Chapter 39 House of Unity. With a large group of others, I boarded a bus early in the morning for the 2-hour drive to Ansong in Gyeonggi Province. The morning was clear and mild. This was my first proper look at my new country by daylight. The trees were budding with bright green leaf. Within the city, and surrounding it far into the distance, were many soft green hills, an iconic Korean landscape familiar to me. As the sun rose, one crest of low hills would materialize in the haze, then the row behind it, and then faintly, the row behind that. Hanawon, which means House of Unity, was among these hills. It is a facility in the countryside south of Seoul that enrolls defectors on a crash course, teaching about the society they'll soon join. Without the 2-month stay there, most North Koreans would not be able to cope. As many discover, freedom, real freedom, in which your life is what you make of it and the choices are your own, can be terrifying. I was high on optimism. I vowed to myself that I would succeed in this beautiful country, no matter what. I would make it proud of me. I thanked it with all my heart for accepting me. The facility is nothing special to look at. A complex of classrooms, dorms, a clinic, dentist, and a cafeteria, all surrounded by a security fence. Yet there is probably nowhere else like it in the world. It is kind of a halfway house between universes, between the parallel careers. People who've crossed the abyss begin to adjust at Hannah One. Few find the transition easy. We were given an allowance to buy snacks and phone cards. I immediately called Kim. This was the first call I'd been allowed to make since arriving in the South. He shouted with joy when he heard me. As time had dragged on, he became seriously worried.
"I thought they'd sent you back to China," he said.
We had a long talk, and when I heard that gentle, relaxed laugh of his, my heart swelled. I could not wait to see him. Next, I called Oki. She had arrived by ferry and had been processed much faster than I had. We talked excitedly. She already had an apartment in Seoul, she said, and was going to job interviews. When I replaced the phone, I wanted to jump in the air. My new life was just weeks away. Later, at the time I had agreed with my mother, I called Haesan. She gave me the news that Mino had a serious girlfriend. Her name was Yunji. My mother said she was very beautiful and from a family of good songbun. Her parents adored Mino. This brought a lump to my throat. I was never going to meet his lucky girl. This complex in Ansong was for women only, and I shared a room with four other girls. I was told that every week the aggressive women I'd been with in the NIS detention room had gone out to meet the bus to see if I was on it. They were so convinced I was Chinese that they'd been taking bets on whether I'd been caught. When I met them again, however, they had softened. I learned that some of them were plagued by guilt over family members they'd left behind, or by memories of terrifying treatment at the hands of the Puibu. They carried that darkness in them so strongly that it obscured their hopes for the future. Despite the tight security, some of them obtained alcohol from the outside and would get rolling drunk, for which they were severely reprimanded by the staff at our morning assemblies. In this more lax environment, fights often broke out too. The bully was there, but she avoided me. My nightmares had stopped, but curiously, it was here, in this haven, that many defectors' ordeals caught up with them and tormented them in dreams. Some suffered breakdowns or panic attacks at the thought of the super-competitive job market they were about to enter. Psychologists were on hand to talk to them, and medics too, to tend to chronic, long-neglected ailments. Many arrivals found it hard to shake off old mentalities. Paranoia, a vital survival tool when neighbours and co-workers were informing on them, prevented them from trusting anyone. Constructive criticism, which everyone needs when learning a new skill, was hard for them to take without feeling accused. I attended classes on democracy, our rights, the law and the media. We were taught how to open bank accounts and how to navigate the subway. We were warned to be careful of con men. Guest lecturers visited. One was a North Korean woman who'd set up a successful bakery in the South. Her self-belief inspired me. Another was a priest who introduced us to the Catholic faith. Many defectors embrace Christianity in the South, but his justification for the celibacy of priests and nuns caused much mirth among the women. Another speaker was a kindly policeman called Mr. Park, who told us what to do in case of emergencies, such as needing an ambulance or reporting a crime. We also attended some extraordinary history classes. For many at Hannah One, their first dogma-free window onto the world. Most defectors' knowledge of history consisted of little more than shining legends from the lives of the great leader and the dear leader. This was when they were told that it was an unprovoked attack from the north, not from the south, that began the Korean War on the 25th of June 1950. Many rejected this loudly and outright. They could not accept that our country's main article of faith, believed by most North Koreans, was a deliberate lie. Even those who knew that North Korea was rotten to the core found the truth about the war very hard to accept. It meant that everything else they had just learned was a lie. It meant that the tears they cried every 25th of June, their decade of military service, all the high-speed battles for protection they had fought, had no meaning. They had been made part of the lie. It was the undoing of their lives. We ate 3 good meals a day, each one different, and everyone put on weight. Eat as much as you like, the staff said. Once you leave here, it may not be so easy to eat well. In fact, the instructors warned us that life generally would be challenging. It might not be easy to find a job, they said. We'd have bills to pay, and if we didn't pay them, we'd get into debt. This was a source of extreme anxiety for those who owed large sums to brokers, who waited daily for them outside the main gates. The staff gave us the impression that the path to a happy and successful future was winding and obscure. I had hoped to hear, work hard, do your best, and you'll succeed. They were trying to manage our expectations, but this vague uncertainty made me nervous. Soon I would no longer need to live by my wits. I would have the freedom to shape my own life. But whenever I tried to picture what lay ahead, I saw not clarity but a swirling fog, and hidden in it were unresolved questions to do with my mother, with Mino, and with Kim. To prevent the creation of a North Korean ghetto, the South Korean government disperses defectors to towns and cities all over the country. We can't choose where we are sent. 99% would prefer Seoul, but given the shortage of housing, only a few were selected. Each of us was given a grant of 19 million won, about $18,500, for housing expenses. I desperately hoped to live in Seoul. I thought my best chance of finding a job was there, and it was where Kim lived. I thought of him every day at Hanawon. I daydreamed about him in classes. I tried to picture his apartment in Gangnam, what it would be like to meet his family, his stylish friends, how he spent his Sunday mornings, with espressos and jazz music and stock market news. My mood plunged, however, when I realized that only 10 people out of hundreds would be chosen for an apartment in Seoul. 10 people. So, to avoid any accusations of unfairness, Hanawon selected the people destined for Seoul by a transparent lottery of numbers placed in a box. In a packed auditorium, a staff member shook the box, as if it were a game show, and picked out 10 numbers. One by one, he called them out. 126, 191, 78, 2, 45. Each winner threw up her arms, cried with happiness, and was embraced by her friends. I was only half listening. The whole spectacle depressed me. I was trying to imagine where else I might get sent in the country. 201, 176, 11. The man was looking around the auditorium. 11. Who has it? The West Coast wouldn't be so bad. 11, come on. A memory came to me of a summer on a beach near Anju, and my father telling me how the moon made the tide go out. I felt a sharp pain in my arm. The woman next to me had poked me. She was pointing at the number in my hand. 11! That's you! Chapter 40. The Learning Race. I was met off the bus by Mr. Park, the smiling policeman who taught us about personal security at Hanawon. "You've moved to my neighbourhood," he said. "I'm here to help." He was in his early 40s and was from the security division of the National Police Agency. His calm authority reminded me a little of my father. He helped me find my feet and to do the paperwork to apply for my South Korean ID and passport. Mr. Park remains one of the most warm-hearted people I have ever met in South Korea. My new home was a small, unfurnished, two-room apartment in the Gumcheon district of southwest Seoul, near Duksan subway station. I was on the 13th floor of a 25-story block. It had a view of similar blocks in the street. There was a large hill behind it. This was not an affluent neighbourhood. Red Cross volunteers had shown me to my apartment. When they said goodbye, and my metal door closed, echoing down the corridor with a clang. I was alone. Not in hiding, but free. I stood at the window for a long time, watching life go by below, and the shadows of the buildings lengthen as the sun moved into the west. I didn't know what to do, I realized. I could go out and buy a mattress and a television and watch soaps all day. I could let laundry and unwashed dishes pile up. I could stand here and wait for summer to turn to autumn, and autumn to winter. The world would not interfere. Freedom was no longer just a concept. Suddenly I felt panicked. It was so frightening and unsettling that I called Oki and asked if I could stay at her apartment that night. Oki was very relieved to see me. After we'd embraced and congratulated ourselves on achieving our dream, we sat on the floor and ate instant noodles. Her own experiences since arriving in Seoul made a sobering story. Despite living for years in Shanghai, as I had, Oki was not finding life here easy. She told me of an experience she'd just had after a job interview. The interviewer told her that he would call her to let her know the company's decision. After days without hearing, she phoned the company and was told that they hadn't called because it was impolite to reject someone directly. North Koreans pride themselves on their directness of speech, an attitude that had been encouraged by Kim Jong-il himself. Foreigners are often taken aback by the bluntness of North Korean diplomats. Oki's experience was the first hint I got that the two Koreas had diverged into quite separate cultures. Worse was to come. After more than 60 years of division and near zero exchange, I would find that the language and values I thought the North and South shared had evolved in very different directions. We were no longer the same people. The next day, Kim flew home from Shanghai and came straight to my apartment. I melted when I saw him. It had been 3 months. We spent a long time simply hugging, pressing our faces together, whispering how much we'd missed each other. I'd missed his touch, his fragrance, his calming voice. He'd grown his hair longer. If it were possible, he was more handsome than he was before. Later, he took me to a big cinema complex in Yongsan. He suggested buying snacks to take into the theater and asked me what I wanted. I read the illuminated menu above the counter. It was in Korean. I couldn't understand a word. What were nachos, popcorn, and cola? Of course, I knew these snacks from China. But English transliterated into Korean words baffled me. And, as I soon found, there were many more. When people mentioned that they were in the elevator, leaving their apato to take a taxi to a meeting, I felt embarrassed. I had no idea what they were talking about. I needed to learn. In fact, I needed a new education. I had grown up in a communist state where the fatherly leader provided for all. The most important quality for all citizens was loyalty, not education, nor even the capacity for hard work. Social status was fixed by the songbun of one's family. In South Korea, too, social status matters a lot, but here it is not hereditary. It is determined through education. And although education is a great leveler in South Korea, even the children of the wealthy get nowhere if they do poorly at school. It brings with it oppressions of its own. It is partly the reason why South Koreans are, according to surveys, the unhappiest people in the developed world. Everyone I seemed to meet was desperate for a good education in order to avoid sinking to the bottom of the pile. In a stampede to avoid this fate, 80% of school students go on to university. Even K-pop stars and athletes take degrees to avoid being perceived as the other 20%. Mothers enroll their children in extra tuition from kindergarten to give them a competitive edge. The pressure mounts so much that school years can be torture. Because so many are awarded degrees, extra credentials are needed if a job candidate is to shine, proficiency in English, and so on. If, after all this struggle, a student gains a position in one of South Korea's star conglomerates, such as Hyundai, Samsung, or LG, then they have made it. North Korean defectors flounder because the education they received back home is worthless in a developed country. If they are too old to return to school, they have to opt for menial work. If they are young enough, they find themselves lagging far behind and lacking confidence. I had been vaguely aware of this while living in Shanghai, but the reality began to bite during those first weeks in Seoul. I knew then what they meant at Hanawon when they said life would be challenging. Without a university degree, I would be no one. Because North Korean defectors are usually in low-paid, low-status jobs, they are looked down upon in South Korea. The discrimination and condescension is seldom overt, but it is felt. For this reason, many defectors try to change their accents and hide their identity when looking for work. I was deeply hurt when I learnt this. I had kept my identity secret for years in China. Would I have to hide it here, too? With Kim's help, my adjustment was going more smoothly than it was for the other defectors I'd known at Hanawon, some of whom were looking for service industry or blue-collar type jobs where they'd be fed at work. I didn't want to do that. I was done with waitressing. I wanted a life that wasn't day-to-day and hand-to-mouth. This took a little time to figure out. After a few weeks, I made the decision to enroll in a 6-month course to become a certified tax accountant. I was good with figures and thought this would position me well for a job. My fellow students were all women. I would soon learn from them how hard it was for South Koreans themselves to be happy in their own society. Many of them had failed to find jobs with prestigious companies and had become depressingly resigned, believing that fate was against them. Minor flaws, being too plump or too short, and misfortunes in love became exaggerated and were perceived as causes of failure. Still, I couldn't help feeling sympathy for them. Every country has worries of its own. Sometimes their complaints sounded like plot lines from TV melodramas. Within only weeks of being reunited with Kim, I began experiencing a romantic melodrama of my own. When Kim and I had lived in Shanghai, our feelings for each other were so strong I was convinced we would marry. I'd waited for him to propose. But after 2.5 years, he had not proposed. Now I understood what had been stopping him. Kim had grown up in Gangnam, the affluent, fashionable district on the south side of the Han River. His family had profited greatly from the boom years, becoming millionaires from soaring property values. He was highly educated, and his parents were also graduates of prestigious universities. As crucial as education is in South Korea, it is not an end in itself. It is the means towards status. And social status is the insurance against the fear that everything may one day turn upside down. In a country that went from being third world to the world's 14th biggest economy in the space of one lifetime, hunger and instability are still lingering memories. If all else fails, a person with status will have family and connections to fall back upon. Kim's friends came from similar backgrounds. Some were well-known actors and models, part of Seoul's beautiful set. When we go for a night out, some of the girls my age would arrive in luxury Western sports cars. Their parents had impressive job titles in the Korean conglomerates. Yet I had nothing. No family, no job, no degree, no money. I had no back, as the South Koreans say, from the English word background, meaning that I had no connections, no support.